Welcome to the fourth episode of Indestructible, Indestructible, Latin America with Rodrigo Acuña. This podcast is a collaborative effort between myself and Alborrada, an independent voice on Latin American politics, media, and culture. I write on political developments in Latin America and am a contributing editor of Alborrada. We're continuing to receive encouraging feedback on this podcast, while the transcripts for the first three episodes are now available on the podcast's Patreon page. If you're interested in supporting us on Patreon, please see the program's notes in our website. As an independent media outlet, any support you can give to this podcast is greatly appreciated. In this episode, I spoke with Alan McLeod, who is a senior staff writer for the US-based independent media outlet Mint Press News. After completing his PhD in 2017, Alan published two books titled Bad News from Venezuela, 20 Years of Fake News and Misreporting, and Propaganda in the Information Age, Still Manufacturing Consent. Both books were published by the distinguished academic publishing house Routledge. More recently, he has contributed an excellent chapter on The Guardian's coverage of Latin America in Capitalism's Conscious, 200 Years of The Guardian, published by Pluto Press. A contributor to other publications like Fair, The Grey Zone, and Jacobin magazine, I spoke to Alan about how the corporate media in the English-speaking world covers Latin America and, amongst numerous issues, what they are not telling us about the region. I now leave you with Alan McLeod. Okay, so Alan, to begin our interview, I'd like to ask you about your professional background. I understand that before you started working as a journalist and as a media analyst, you also worked in academia. What was that experience like working in the university sector, and why did you decide on a career in media instead?
Yeah, sure. So a few years ago, I was finishing up my PhD in sociology. It was about how media represent Latin America in the West. And I'd done a bit of teaching, especially in Latin American politics, but a lot of the academics that were close to me kind of gave me the impression that, you know, they were kind of warning me off it, frankly, saying that it's kind of a closing door in terms of trying to get into that profession, where there are fewer and fewer tenured jobs and more people from around the world trying to get them. And as I was finishing up my PhD and turning it into a book, I decided that I should really start writing some articles to try and promote the book. And most of them went to, you know, Latin American or media outlets. And one of them was Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And I wrote a couple of articles for them, which I thought were pretty much just promoting my book and just reporting on what was going on in Venezuela. I wasn't expecting to get any money for it, but I got a check for a few hundred dollars in the mail a few weeks later. And I was really surprised about that, because frankly, I think I made as much money promoting the book, writing articles, than I did from the book itself after years of it being out. So I started thinking, well, you know, I've got this other book that I'm working on. Maybe I should, you know, turn one of those chapters into an article for them as well. And they liked it, they went with it. And that's really where the journalism part of my my career sort of took off. I'd never really considered becoming a journalist exactly, but I kind of fell into it, which is quite unusual, I think, nowadays. I think journalism is a very difficult field to get into, especially writing about important stuff for alternative media, because there's just a huge lack of money in that industry. And so I do feel quite lucky to have a job and have had one for a couple of years now. Since after I started writing for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, I was recommended by a journalist, Whitney Webb, to write for Mint Press News. And I've been there for 2 years now, and I've got a lot of freedom to write about what I want. I have the ability, pre-corona anyway, to travel and work as I travel as well, write about all sorts of things that are important and also make a career out of it. So I certainly feel very blessed.
Mm-hmm. And you're certainly very productive, which is really interesting, and part of the reason why you've certainly, you know, I've come under my sort of radar, and there are a lot of Latin American analysts that are following your work. Now, you predominantly write on Latin American and US politics. While I do want to discuss US politics and the media further on in this interview with you, first I'd like to know why you're looking at Latin America and what are some of the big stories the mainstream media is not reporting on the region.
Oh, Latin America is such an exciting region politically and socially. I mean, for the last 20 years, it's been in pretty much open rebellion against the United States, even though many people in the West don't know that. And one of the reasons is that there's so little media coverage of it, you know? So Latin America is a great place to look at if you're somebody who's politically engaged, but is tired of just taking crushing L after crushing L if you live in the US or the UK or Australia or anywhere. And so it's a really exciting place to see where progressive and radical movements are really taking power and improving people's lives. But one of the big stories that people don't really talk about is the US role in putting down and opposing these progressive governments, sponsoring coups, political parties, organizations, etc. One big story that happened recently was John McAvoy broke the report about the Department of Health writing a big report where they boasted that they were working with all sorts of three-letter organizations in Washington to stop the malign influence of Russia and Venezuela and Cuba in the region. And the examples that they provided themselves were stopping Brazil buying the Russian vaccine and stopping Panama from accepting Cuban doctors to help them with their COVID-19 recovery and defense strategy. And what that clearly shows is, you know, Brazil and Panama have been absolutely overrun by the virus with, I think in Brazil is well over 300,000 people have died from it now. And so these actions are, you know, costing uncountable thousands of lives across Latin America. And we just don't really hear about it. Another thing, you know, that they've managed to do is really hamper and stymie the production of a domestic Latin American COVID-19 vaccine in Cuba, for instance. The Soberana 02 vaccine is in the final stages of testing, but they've had terrible problems with sanctions, which means that that domestic vaccine is really being stymied. Another way that the United States is also hampering the development of Latin America is through sanctions. A story that we really should be reading about on the front pages is how United Nations rapporteurs are suggesting that 100,000 Venezuelans have died from the US sanctions. And they're also sanctioning countries like Nicaragua and Cuba too. But these are the sorts of things that the corporate world, the corporate media anyway, are really just not reporting on. So we're getting this very one-sided, frankly, very shallow reporting on Latin America, an entire continent, which I think if people knew about it, they would be energized and very interested in.
Yes, yes. You have written two books on the media, the first being Bad News from Venezuela, 20 Years of Fake News and Misreporting in 2018, and Propaganda in the Information Age, Still Manufacturing Consent in 2019. Both books were published by Routledge. In your latest book, Propaganda in the Information Age, you write, and I quote, "The media is not your friend. The media is a weapon of the elite in the battle for your mind. They are not plucky truth tellers, but for the most part are enormously powerful corporations propagandizing us for their own interests and agendas. They do not challenge power, they are power. the voice of the powerful. The mass media is not trying to provide the public with factual information, but rather to gaslight and propagandize them into subservience and support for elite positions, most of which are against our own interest. End quote. Could you elaborate on how the media propagandizes us for their own interest and agendas, as you put it?
Sure. There's this old idea about how the media works, and we have this sense that journalists are plucky truth tellers armed with nothing but a pencil and a pad of paper and a printing press. But even if that was true 50 or 100 years ago, it's certainly not true today. The reality is that the large majority of the media we consume comes from enormous corporate empires, and journalists are really cogs in that machine. These big transnational corporations have their own interests and their own affairs that they're looking out for. Something like 90% of everything that we read, see, or hear comes from just six companies. This is the United States, but it's a similar story in the United Kingdom, in Australia, and elsewhere. In the 2000s, there was this idea that maybe the internet would set us free and that new methods of communication would open up and that we might be able to break this increasingly controlled system. But in fact, what we've seen in the internet era is the rise of enormous monolithic monopolies such as Amazon, Facebook, Google, Twitter, etc., which are actually even more concentrated in ownership, and they have their own agendas as well. Generally, media is owned by enormous billionaires, like, for instance, Rupert Murdoch, or by unknown thousands of shareholders who have pretty much the same interest as Rupert Murdoch, which is to, one, make a lot of money in the short term, and two, push forward a very certain way of looking at the world, a way which in general is very much against what the interests of the majority would be. The interests of the top 1%, the billionaire class, tend to be diametrically opposed to the 99% because their interests are increasing their share of the wealth, which means driving down wages, or increasing their profits by pushing up prices, which again hurts the 99%. These organizations are considerably controlled by advertising. Generally, who funds big outlets tend to be transnational corporations like, you know, Walmart in the United States or Woolworths and Coles in Australia or whatever. And then, you know, you've got like big energy companies, big transport companies like Ford or Toyota or whatever. And these corporations make sure that their ideas and their point of view is very much put forward. They do not want to advertise in outlets which share a very differing point of view, which might harm their bottom line. It's very difficult to get into journalism nowadays. And generally, the main route in is by doing apprenticeships or internships. And that means, for the most part, that means going to somewhere like Washington, D.C., New York, London, these big metropolises, and then working for free for 6 months or 12 months. And that is just not really possible for the bottom, let's say, 90% of the population. And so mm-hmm. for the last few decades, what we've seen is journalism is becoming an increasingly elite, increasingly elite profession. So now you are more likely to have gone to an Ivy League university, which is the creme de la creme, the, you know, private fee-paying universities in the United States, if you're a yes. journalist than if you're a US senator. And so we really don't have a wide range of views expressed in our biggest and most powerful media. You know, somebody like Rupert Murdoch, who owns hundreds of outlets across the world, makes sure that his views in particular appear on the opinion page. So it was no surprise to me to see that of the more than 170 newspapers he owns, every single one of them came out in support of the Iraq War, which was his position. And so while we like to think of journalists as being free and independent, in reality, they are quite often told from the top what to write. And even if they aren't, they are still selected by people who've been put in place by those billionaires in the first place. And they make sure that their politics, the outlook of those journalists, is at least on side with what they believe, if not exactly the same. And so really what the media is about trying to push forward ideas in society to make the outlook, the beliefs, the worldview of the top 1%, trying to make that become the common sense default position, and trying to sort of stymie or put to one side any sort of alternative ways of thinking. That's what the scholar Gramsci called hegemony. I think that's exactly what's going on. You know, that is what the media, for the most part, again, there are some great exceptions, generally ones that are not funded by this model. That's what the media is about. It's a machine to manufacture consent for elite opinions.
Yes. And of course, when you do have rare cases of journalists straying from that, from those key positions, like Chris Hedges, for example, at the New York Times, they're often given their marching orders. Interesting. Now, in both of your books, you make reference to the late economist Edward S. Herman and the linguist and world famous intellectual dissident Noam Chomsky's classic 1988 work, Manufacturing Consent: The Political Economy of the Mass Media. Specifically, you refer to what Herman and Chomsky called the propaganda model and the five filters that are used in the for-profit private media before news stories are printed or go on air on television. For those who are unaware of Herman and Chomsky's work, what are these five filters, and what do you think can be said about their work and its relevance in 2021?
You know, when I was a teenager and in my early 20s, I was always interested in politics, but whenever I was watching the media, I always knew there was something wrong with what they were giving me, but I could never really put my finger on it because I didn't have any sort of background of theory to really understand it. I just kind of imbibed the fact that I'm not really welcome in this space. And it wasn't until I found that book, Manufacturing Consent by Herman and Chomsky, that I really started to understand how the media works. And that really sparked my interest in the subject and the reason why I did a PhD. So Herman and Chomsky wrote this seminal book in 1988 called Manufacturing Consent. And they laid out how the media works. You know, there are pretty much an infinite amount of stories that are going on in the outside world. Mm-hmm. But how do news outlets decide which ones of the thousands, the millions that they could write about today or give to you on your TV today, how do they decide which ones actually make it there? And they say that there are five filters that the media use to decide which stories are selected and which stories are jettisoned. And those five filters are the ownership, corporate advertising, sources, flack, and ideology. Ownership refers to the size and concentration of who actually owns these outlets. This is getting worse and worse. When Herman and Chomsky wrote it, they were sounding the alarm that in the United States, only 55 companies controlled pretty much all of the viewing habits or the reading habits of Americans. But it's actually much worse today. Now it's only six.
Wow.
One example is Jeff Bezos, the world's richest man. He owns Amazon, Whole Foods, all of these big businesses. He also owns the Washington Post, one of the most important and influential news outlets in the United States and the world. And Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting have done many studies of the Washington Post coverage and found that it is very often highly, highly sympathetic to Amazon, to Whole Foods, and to Jeff Bezos in general.
Okay.
Corporate advertising is another one. We are more reliant on ever than ever on handouts from big businesses who advertise with us. That's because money for journalism has been shrinking for years because of increased competition from the internet. Increasingly, we're seeing advertorials and sponsored content in outlets which really blur the line between journalism and propaganda. You know, one example is Bill Gates, the second richest man in the world. His foundation pretty much underwrites an entire section of the Guardian newspaper, his cities and world development. And again, you can see that Bill Gates gets extremely good coverage in pretty much every outlet that yes. he gives money to. He gives yes. money to dozens of outlets, you know, the BBC, the Guardian, Al Jazeera, Le Monde, NBC Universal. It's really across the board. A third one is sourcing. Who you go to really affects how you're going to write. Your sources really shape the way that you think about the news and how you as a journalist are going to write the story or present the coverage. And generally, those sources are elite. You don't go to the man on the street. You don't really go to unions. You go to, you know, businesses. You go to government officials. You go to spokespeople for big corporations, etc. And generally, that means that you are repeating the official line. We've now seen the rise of anonymous sourcing, which is very common, where a U.S. official tells somebody from CNN or the New York Times something scandalous, but they refuse to put their name to it, and it's just treated as if it's you know, the gospel. So we've seen in the last couple of years all sorts of stories about Russia and China doing bad things in the West.
Yes.
But when you actually get down to it, it's an anonymous State Department official saying this. And not only that, they're, you know, they were refusing to give their own name to put it to there. And this is like, as a journalist, you should say, you know, probably the most unreliable source for you entirely is a spy. But, you know, an anonymous spy is even worse. Yes. And yet they make up a large percentage of what we're actually reading nowadays. The fourth filter was flack. That means organized pushback to your stories. This can take the form of letter writing campaigns, emails, advertising, you know, denouncing you, etc. Pressure groups. This is easier than ever to really organize in the internet age, where you can get people from around the world to gin up hostility towards, you know, something that somebody's written. And that has an effect of disciplining journalists, knowing that they shouldn't go towards these controversial subjects, whether it's, you know, what the West is doing in the Middle East or in Latin America, for instance, because
Israel, for example.
Yeah, always. That's a good example.
Yes.
Where if you write something that is seen to be too pro-Palestinian or too anti-Israel, you're going to get your bosses are going to get phone calls. They might lose, you know, advertising as well. So journalists kind of instinctively know that they probably shouldn't, you know, touch that subject at all. And the last one is ideology, which back in Herman and Chomsky's day, they talked about anti-communism as an ideology and the prevailing sense that capitalism is the best way of over-organizing things. Obviously, the Soviet Union went away, but in the last 2-3 years, we've really seen the rise of this sort of anti-Russian sentiment across the West. And suddenly, if you start reporting in a way which angers the elite, suddenly you tend to start being told that you're repeating Russian talking points or that you're a Russian sympathizer, which, you know, almost always is completely crazy. But that is now another disciplining effect of the media. So we've got these five things which kind of intersect with each other to filter out certain stories that the elite just think they wouldn't do to actually talk about. And unfortunately, that's what happens online as well. You know, we think about Facebook and Twitter, etc., as being these places where we can share stories and, you know, go around the corporate nexus. But actually, if you look at what's shared on there, it tends to just be stuff from legacy media like ABC or SBS or the BBC and ITV in the UK or Fox and CNN in the US. And so there's very little genuinely new and unique stuff being shared online. And so, yes, unfortunately, it's just another echo chamber where we're being fed the same stuff. And so I think Herman Chomsky's propaganda model is pretty much more applicable than ever, even though they wrote it in the 80s. It's the media has changed, but changed for the worse, which makes their case stronger than ever.
Okay. In your book, Bad News from Venezuela, you are extremely critical of journalists from Europe and the United States that arrive in Venezuela to cover political events. In your view, despite the fact that some of them do travel to Venezuela to do their reporting, they are almost systematically failing to provide their audiences with an accurate picture of developments on the ground. Why do you think this is the case? And maybe explain to us this process.
This really became clear when I started to interview a lot of journalists who do report from South America. What I found is very often there's a concept called parachute journalism, where Westerners are dropped into situations that they don't understand. They fly in, stay at the Hilton Hotel, maybe meet somebody who was prearranged for them, who speaks English, write a story, and then just get out of there. That means that there is an extremely low level of understanding of a society and a culture there. Found that probably most of these journalists don't even speak Spanish when they're being dropped into South America, which is, which just means that they have no ability to speak to the bottom 90-something percent of the population. In Venezuela in particular, but this is again applicable across South America, it's a very dangerous city, is Caracas. Yes. Journalists who do, even journalists who do live there, tend to live in walled citadels surrounded with armed guards. They're driven everywhere, and even their media outlets say that they probably shouldn't venture into these dangerous, dilapidated slums where the majority of the people live. And so what happens is that journalists kind of imbibe this elite mentality because they are surrounded at all times by the elite of the country, who generally speak English, who are privately educated, have a very different view on what's going on in Latin America, and particularly in Venezuela, than the rest of the population. So they kind of just end up, they've essentially pre-selected that their entire audience, their worldview, everybody they interact with are opposition supporters, are members of the elite. And that comes out in their reporting. Critical journalists who I talk to who don't like the coverage say that they end up self-censoring, that they end up not pitching ideas that they would otherwise, because they just know that their editors are not going to like it. And they also know that if they go into their newsroom and start talking the way they do, they're going to get a lot of aggro from the rest of them, who a lot of whom are committed anti-government activists and see themselves as the ideological tip of the spear against these progressive movements who've come to power. And so many people don't even realize this is going on. But if you start off with that critical mentality, you end up, even if you don't lose it in your mind, the work that you put out is very bland and very often contrary to what you believe in. Now, the local media in Latin America is highly, highly politicized and is linked to political and economic actors like, you know, big businesses. And journalists have to live in this milieu where they're working alongside local Venezuelan journalists who, again, you know, the media in Venezuela are perhaps the prime member of the opposition. They were, you know, pretty much organized coups against Hugo Chavez in 2002 and later as well, with cries of not one step backwards on their front pages and everybody out to the presidential palace, crying that out on the airwaves. And when you're working with these sorts of people, you just kind of imbibe their mentality. You know, one journalist who I interviewed said that if you say that Hugo Chavez or the socialists are anything other than a Nazi blitzkrieg taking over Venezuela, then they are onto you. That's what he told me.
Wow.
So there's this extreme pressure to conform. And most journalists already going to Venezuela with a certain, you know, kind of understanding of what's going on without the ability to speak Spanish, talking to elite sources, they just kind of fall into this mentality and they start reproducing what is effectively opposition propaganda. And that's really what came out when I started talking to these people.
Okay.
In fact, one extra thing I might say is that I also interviewed a former, I think he was working for Bloomberg, journalist. He was from Russia. But he said, he told me on camera that he consciously plants exaggerated, I would say false, stories into international media because he sees himself as a mercenary for hire, which is his own words. He used the phrase sexy tricks to describe what he was doing. This was before the word fake news really became a worldwide phenomenon. But that is essentially what he was saying. He was planting fake stories into the media because, you know, he was an anti-government revolutionary. And the fact is like, if he was willing to say that on camera to a researcher he didn't even know, what is he actually saying in private when, you know, closed doors? He's behind closed doors.
Yes.
And after I published that, there was no scandal or anything. In fact, he's been promoted. He now is a pretty senior writer for the New York Times, which is, you know, the gold standard of journalism. So in fact, when you write like this, it's kind of a sense of failing upward, because ultimately that is what the media is for. It's there to defame these left movements, these progressive movements. And he was excellent at it because he had, you know, no moral qualms about writing whatever he was told.
Interesting. Interesting. Continuing with your book on Venezuela, you have written a whole chapter on the role of the foreign media, or the role that the foreign media played in the 2002 coup against President Hugo Chavez, and in more recent times, the numerous attempts to overthrow President Nicolas Maduro. As noted in the Irish documentary, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, the Venezuelan corporate media also played a role in supporting the coup. In supporting the coup, as a pro-US section of the military kidnapped President Chavez. Could you explain to our audience how both the Venezuelan domestic media and the international media play a role in politics? And I guess you have in part answered that, but I'm just thinking how you could elaborate a little bit further on that connection between the two.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the 2002 coup is very often called a mediatic coup in Venezuela. And that's because the media played the key role in driving people out in the streets and organizing. For instance, Gustavo Cisneros, who is Venezuela's richest man, often called Venezuela's Rupert Murdoch for the amount of media he controls. His mansion was the headquarters of the coup. And we know from Freedom of Information Act documents that the US ambassador was also at his house at the headquarters on the day of the coup. Other big opposition figures like Miguel Otero, who owns El Nacional, he moonlights as an opposition activist as well. Mm-hmm. And on the front pages of the Venezuelan newspapers, you know, as I said, there were, you know, headlines like "Not One Step Backwards" and
yes,
everybody out to the Miraflores presidential palace. And, you know, I suppose the media's role in Venezuela is to try to delegitimize the progressive forces. But, you know, you said, what do the Venezuelan domestic media and the international media, what are their roles? You know, sometimes I think it's probably better not to think of them as two separate entities, because very often, you will read in Western outlets like the New York Times, Washington Post, Guardian, ABC, etc., you will see that the reporters often have Spanish-sounding names. And that's because of these enormous cuts that pretty much all outlets are having. most Western outlets have outsourced their Venezuelan reporting to local Venezuelan journalists who are connected to these big powerhouse media outlets who were involved in the coup. And so generally that means that opposition propaganda is being passed off as objective reporting. And the fact is that most people just don't know enough about Latin America to know that that's going on. You know, basically, I think their role is to try to delegitimize the progressive forces that in Venezuela and in Latin America. You know, it's the idea is, you know, don't look over here for ideas. Even though many groups in Europe, for instance, the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn, Podemos in Spain or Syriza in Greece were completely overtly saying that Venezuela might be, there are certain things that we should be following here because it's an inspiring thing that we should all be learning about. Yes. But yeah, I suppose that's the role of the international media. It's about legitimizing delegitimizing the left and legitimizing the right. We saw that in Bolivia, for instance, in 2019 in the coup, where to this day most media outlets are refusing to even call it a coup, and even progressive outlets were describing the massacres going on by the far-right death squads as, you know, clashes between rival groups of protesters, which means that, you know, we're just left to guess about who was committing the violence. And I suppose that's really the point of the media. Yeah, the point is to try to muddy clear waters and clear up muddy waters, really, to, you know, to give their audience a certain view of Latin America, that view aligning with what their owners and their advertisers want you to think about the place.
Mm-hmm. And your information you've just provided sort of follows on to the next question that I had for you, which is the, you know, you have been following developments in Bolivia, where in 2019 a military coup took place that was backed by the Trump administration, the Organization of American States, and right-wing governments throughout Latin America against the MAS administration of President Evo Morales. Now, MAS, for those who are unaware, stands for the Movement for Socialism, while Morales was the country's first indigenous president, as well as a leader who came from a trade union movement background. In your recent article on Bolivia at Mint Press, you are highly critical of the US organization Human Rights Watch, specifically for their criticisms of the recent arrest of Jeanne Añez Chávez, who was installed by the opposition after the coup as president. Could you elaborate on your criticisms of Human Rights Watch and what you think has been happening in Bolivia in recent years? And again, what are we not being informed about by the mainstream corporate media?
Well, I suppose the background of Bolivia is that the first indigenous president was elected in 2005, Evo Morales. This is in a country where up to 90% of the country has indigenous heritage. Morales served three terms in which poverty was drastically reduced, and extreme poverty even more so. There were huge campaigns against illiteracy, against hunger, etc. And we saw the country becoming a much more equal society. Morales was by far and away the most charismatic and the most popular leader that Bolivia has ever sought to. He sought to run for a fourth term, which was actually against certain laws they had. They had a referendum in Bolivia about this, where that question, among others, was put to the public, and the public decided by about 50 to 49 to prevent Morales from running for a fourth term. But then the Supreme Court got involved and said that actually this was against certain laws in Bolivia, and that on, you know, freedom of speech issues and other sorts of things that that Morales should be allowed to stand for a fourth term. At the time, I personally thought, well, you know, the public has decided, so maybe Morales should just, you know, run to be a senator or perhaps in the cabinet and let someone else, maybe someone younger, take over. But he decided in 2019 to run anyway. And clearly it wasn't that big of an issue for the Bolivians because he won the election by over 10 points in October 2019. Mm-hmm. But what we saw right after that was claims that Morales had fixed the election, and suddenly there was organized groups, armed groups in the streets claiming that Morales had stolen the election. And suddenly the army was out on the streets, and generals were going on television saying that if Morales did not resign right now, there was going to be bloodshed. So Morales fled the country, went to Mexico originally, and then went to Argentina later. He said specifically that he was doing this to prevent further bloodshed because mass members had been kidnapped, had been tortured, had been paraded through the streets. Morales' family's houses had been bombed. It was clear that there was going to be some sort of civil war. And it was also crystal clear that this was a classic Latin American military coup where the generals go on television and say, we're taking charge.
Yes.
That's the backdrop. The Organization of the American States, of American States and Human Rights Watch promoted this idea that Morales had actually fiddled the votes. But it seems pretty clear what had happened. Even at the time, it was pretty obvious what had happened was that there was this, that the first quick count came in and said Morales had won by 9.5%. And then after all the votes were counted, he'd actually won by 10.5%, which is important because if you win by over 10%, that means that you avoid any sort of election runoff and you win outright. So there's no need for a second round of voting. That should have been pretty obvious that that was going to happen because Bolivia is a very large and not very well connected country. There are a lot of people living in remote valleys, in the highlands, etc. And Morales drew his support from these people. He himself was a cocalero, a farmer that grew coca leaf. And you know, the writing should have been on the wall when he was up by 9.5% after all the urban votes had been counted. And then when the rural votes come in, you know, his lead increased. Something similar to this actually happened in November in the United States, where for a few hours it seemed like Donald Trump was actually ahead. But when all the postal votes came in, which is how the Democrats had been voting and how Trump had actually said, do not vote by post, so his supporters didn't. Suddenly, Joe Biden surged ahead and won pretty easily. Mm-hmm. Kind of a similar thing happened there. But Human Rights Watch feigned ignorance and started to say that Morales was actually, you know, an anti-democratic force. And its leader, Ken Roth, actually started celebrating it, calling it a democratic outbreak. A democratic outbreak that, you know, military was out there, you know, insisting that an elected president get kicked out. You know, called himself, you know, he called the protesters that they were defending democracy against electoral fraud and an illegal candidate. And then he even claimed that Morales had ordered the army to shoot protesters, which is utterly ludicrous. Now, Human Rights Watch is, of course, an American organization, as you said. They're headed up in New York. Their headquarters are in the Empire State Building. And I think that is quite ironic and fitting because ultimately that is what Human Rights Watch is about. It is about, you know, preserving the US empire, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
You know, Human Rights Watch called, so I should say that Morales was kicked out and the military decided on Jeanine Añez to be the new president. She came from a party that only won 4% of the vote in that election. And she immediately told the military, she signed a document saying that they were pre-exonerated of any crimes committed during the reestablishment of order.
Yes.
And that was universally understood as go out and kill as many people as you want. And that is exactly what they did. Mm-hmm. Now, Human Rights Watch called that decree a problematic decree, as if she was using racially insensitive language, not ordering massacres. And so ultimately, that is what they've been doing. They've been running defense for this coup regime. And their narrative was completely destroyed in 2020 when the Bolivian people got the chance to vote again in new elections, which only happened because they shut the entire country down with a general strike, which lasted weeks. They gave the mass, not Morales, because he was banned from participating, but Morales' economy minister, an enormous mandate where he received almost double the amount of votes of any other person.
Wow.
And so ultimately, their position has been repudiated. But ultimately, I think Human Rights Watch's credibility should also have been repudiated as well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you look back on Human Rights Watch's history, it was actually started as an organization called Helsinki Watch. It was started as a Western organization that was supposed to monitor the crimes of Eastern Bloc countries that were not living up to the rights of the Helsinki Accords, which was basically a time when the Eastern Bloc said, yes, we'll let, you know, Westerners in to monitor our human rights situation.
Mm-hmm.
Human Rights Watch still refuses to take a position on the Iraq War, the biggest human rights violation of the 21st century.
Okay.
Their founder, Ariel Nauria, says that economic rights like the right to food and the right to water and, you know, union rights are fundamentally authoritarian and, you know, are not human rights at all, even though they're enshrined in the UN Charter, which is
correct.
Ultimately the bedrock of any sort of discourse around human rights.
Yes.
And so, yeah, ultimately, Human Rights Watch, they haven't really ever met a US-sponsored coup they didn't like. And unfortunately, that is pretty much their role in Latin America, even though they do come up with lots of good reporting on other parts of the world. It's always, you know, framed in a very certain way, which is pretty friendly to US interests, ultimately, yeah.
Okay. Now, within Latin America, but also on a global level, political developments in Ecuador have been important, given the radical change that the government of Lenin Moreno took in 2017, in contrast to that of Rafael Correa, whom Lenin previously worked under as vice president and was part of this leftist sort of coalition, these left-wing governments that you've been discussing. As we know, the Correa administration was allied with Latin America's progressive governments, Juan Moreno, who, as a member of Correa's party, ran on a platform to continue the citizens' revolution. Once in power, did a 180-degree turn in 2017. Domestic policies were changed to be more market-friendly. Relations with Washington improved, while Quito turned its back on the promotion of the Union of South American Nations, who some would argue is South America's answer to the European Union, although with a far more progressive agenda to meet the region's needs with issues like poverty, health, education. Moreno also had Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks founder and a dual Australian and Ecuadorian citizen, handed over to British authorities for possible extradition to the United States. And Moreno himself has been accused of corruption and having his name appear in the Panama Papers. What is your take on developments in Ecuador? And again, how is the mainstream media covering this country?
Well, generally, one tactic the media has used is try to separate the quote-unquote good left from the bad left. And what the good left was that they were countries like Brazil or Uruguay, which didn't, you know, start mass nationalization of resources, but they did try to alleviate poverty, a more soft left approach, whereas the hard left approach was much more aggressive and antagonistic towards the United States. Those are countries like Venezuela, Cuba, Bolivia, and Ecuador. And so when Lenin Moreno came to power in 2017, and as you said, performed this great turnaround where he first pretended to be a leftist and the disciple of Rafael Correa, who had reduced poverty and increased the GDP of Ecuador. When he turned around and suddenly became very sort of conventionally neoliberal right wing, they gave him a lot of rope and they were very pleased to see that it happened. And so when enormous protests erupted in Ecuador 2 years ago, which, you know, paralyzed the country, and Moreno's government started violently suppressing them, those protests were essentially ignored by the media. One study I did for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting showed that there was over 60 times the coverage of the Hong Kong protests as the Ecuador protests, even though I think you could pretty much say that objectively the Ecuadorian protests were more important of the amount of people that were dying in these things. So yeah, Lenin Moreno is certainly an unpopular figure in Ecuador. His approval ratings are in the single digits. And as we're speaking, we're going into the next and probably final round of voting in Ecuador's election, where we very likely will see Andrés Arauz, a disciple of Rafael Correa, come back to power. And this will really mark a new return for the rebel alliance, where, you know, in Bolivia, we've seen the return of the MAS. In Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba, all three of those governments have managed to deal with US threats and continue. We've seen in Argentina, a leftist government come back. Now there are rumblings in Brazil that Lula might stand for election in 2022. He's already by far the most popular candidate, according to polls. And so this could be another data point on the path back for the radical left in Latin America. But I don't expect very much coverage of this, because that is not really a story that people in Washington, New York, Sydney, London, etc., really want their readers to know about, in case they get ideas about what they could do in their countries.
Yes. Now, moving on to the United States, the Democrats have returned to power after the colossal debacle of the Trump administration. In your opinion, what are some of the most significant political and economic trends taking place in the United States in recent years? And what do you think the Biden administration will mean for Latin America?
Well, I guess in terms of economics, it's a similar picture that has been developing for the last 40 years after the US really abandoned a more Keynesian approach and went to a more neoliberal free market orientation of their economics. What that's meant is that jobs have been offshored to Mexico or to China and India, and generally inequality has been growing. And also has, and also the standard of living across the United States has been falling for many decades. And I think it's very difficult to understand the sorts of strife, the sorts of social problems that are going on in the United States, the rise of Trump, etc., the rise of the alt-right, without really understanding that background dynamic where people for more than one generation now have been seeing their standards of living dropping. I suppose in the last few years, we've seen, you know, the rise of the right and also the sort of Bernie Sanders left challenging the establishment center. However, Biden did manage to get elected on a very, what we call centrist, but is really center-right platform. His plans for Latin America, I think there are far more similarities to the Trump administration than differences. So for instance, Biden would like to see the return of Plan Colombia for Colombia, which was this militarization of the drug war, which killed thousands of people. In April, we're going to see the return of chemical spraying of the Colombian countryside, something that had been postponed for over 6 years because of its unpopularity and because of the deadly consequences of it. Biden also has a plan for Central America called Plan Biden, which is based on Plan Colombia, which is the militarization of the refugee problem that's going on the US's southern border. If you don't know, there are tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people in countries like Honduras who have fled because of political strife. Very often, the problems in those countries are actually a direct consequence of the United States's political decisions. For instance, overthrowing the democratically elected government in Honduras in 2009. In terms of Venezuela, it's pretty much full steam ahead with regime change. Biden continues to support Juan Guaido, who was Donald Trump's favored politician in Venezuela. He's never stood for office, and yet they still recognize him as the legitimate president of the country. For Brazil, and for Latin America more generally, Biden, his administration told the New York Times that they would like to see a return to Lava Jato, the car wash anti-corruption crusade that the US had been pushing in Brazil, which led to the impeachment of the leftist government of Dilma Rousseff and the imprisonment of Lula da Silva. They said they would like to try to expand that across Latin America. I don't really see many Latin American governments, you know, being on side with this and cooperating with that, given what we've seen in the 2010s, but you never know. So ultimately, I think even though the figurehead has changed in Washington, the general outlook and the general way forward has really not changed, whether it's Republicans or Democrats. Mm-hmm. And that is really the case of Latin America for 200 years. You know, in the 1820s, President Monroe signed something called the Monroe Doctrine, which basically declared that the United States controls the Western Hemisphere and that other powers like Europe should just stay out of it. And if you read internal US documents, ones that have been declassified, they constantly refer back to the Monroe Doctrine, which essentially, as I said, declares that the United States is the sovereign across the Western Hemisphere and that Latin America is that country's backyard. And ultimately, Biden is treating Latin America as America's backyard, just as Trump did, just as Obama did, just as George Bush did. So there are far more similarities than differences between Trump and Biden.
Okay. Now, finally, you are a staff writer for Mint Press News and publish with other independent media outlets like Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. What is your perception of the reach or impact the independent media is having on the wider public in, say, Europe, the United States, or Latin America? And do you feel independent media outlets are getting enough support from other sectors like trade unions, which some would argue should be far more supportive of the independent press?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I suppose in reality, alternative news outlets, while they do provide a really important resource for plenty of people, they have nothing like the reach of big legacy media outlets like, you know, ABC or the BBC or CNN or what have you. As I said earlier, the internet really provided a lot of people with an alternative way of accessing information. But unfortunately, since 2016 and the development of the concern over fake news and the concern over foreign interference, algorithms for Google, for Facebook, for Twitter, and all the big media giants have been changed under the guise of fighting fake information. But the reality is that alternative news outlets have been some of the biggest victims of that. So I know that Mint Press has lost something like 90% of its viewers since 2016. And that pretty much happened overnight. And there are similar stories across all sorts of alternative media outlets like Common Dreams, like The Intercept, like Democracy Now!, which was that as soon as Google changed how it ranked outlets, these alternative media outlets were just sort of deranked, delisted, demonetized, and demoted, and in a few cases, deleted as well. And so we're under pretty big attack from more mainstream outlets who are trying to re-tighten their grip over the means of communication, which they lost significantly with the arrival and the growth of the internet. Ultimately, I suppose, the great media scholar Mickey Huff said that if media reform isn't at least your second issue, you've got a problem, because you're not going to win a better world without more support from the media. How is anybody really going to, you know, find out about your cause unless you're really passionate about changing the media landscape? Because ultimately we rely on newspapers, on TV shows, on outlets just to provide us with information. I would love to see more help from unions and progressive organizations in fighting this, because ultimately, if we don't change the media, nothing is going to change. It's not, you know, in Latin America, people can fight their own battles, but things in the West are not going to change unless we have a sea change in the way in which we receive and communicate with, receive information and communicate with each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, here in Australia, the former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd has been campaigning to have serious media reform and have a royal commission into the power that Rupert Murdoch has in this country. So, yes, certainly reforms, major reforms, need to take place in Europe, in the United States, and countries like Australia. Alan McLeod, a staff writer for Mint Press News, thank you very much for talking to us here at Indestructible, Indestructible.
It was great to talk to you. Real pleasure.
Thank you.
That concludes the fourth episode of Indestructible. Once again, I would like to thank Alborada for this opportunity to host Indestructible and would encourage our listeners to support this podcast on Patreon. You can do this for as little as the price of one cup of coffee a month. My sincere thanks, as always, goes to Alborada's founder and co-editor, Pablo Navarrete, who produces this podcast. If you have any feedback on this episode, please write to us on our email, which you will find on the website. Soon, we'll be back with episode 5, but until then, goodbye and stay safe.